The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Book of Serenity, case number 32. Yangshan's mind and environment. Yangshan asked the monk, "Where were you born?" The monk said, "I am from Yu province." "Do you consider the inside of it?" "I always do." And then Yangshan replies, "That which thinks is consciousness. That which is thought about is environment. Within that are mountains, rivers, and the great earth, towers, palaces, people, animals, and other things. But reflect upon the consciousness that thinks. Are there a lot of things there?" "I don't see anything at all there." "That's correct so far as belief is concerned, but it's not enough for human life. Do you have some other advice?" "It doesn't hit the mark to say that sometimes there's something and sometimes there isn't. When you look, you see only a dark vastness. From now on, focus on sitting down and wearing clothes." So here we are, sitting down and wearing clothes. And considering this dialogue featuring great Chinese ancestor Yangshan. Yangshan taught in the 9th century. This dialogue is recorded in a collection from the 12th century in China. The Book of Serenity, sometimes called the Book of Equanimity. And like many koans, it's in dialogue form. Sometimes the dialogue is between a teacher and someone who's obviously a fairly beginning student or not far from beginning. Lots of koans like this. That we encounter early on when we work through the gateless gate. Monk goes to Zhaozhou and says, "I'm new here. Please instruct me. Have you had breakfast?" "Yes, then go wash your bowl." Great little dialogue. But not so much in it as we find in later dialogues like this one with Yangshan. Some dialogues are between two great teachers, two equals, and sometimes they take the form of Dharma combats where the teachers are more or less playfully testing each other. Sometimes they take the form of just wonderful sharing of the life of the Dharma. And then there are a lot of koans that feature dialogues somewhere in between that. Dialogues between a great teacher like Yangshan and then someone who may be a more advanced practitioner, maybe someone who thinks that they're quite an advanced practitioner. And we start to encounter a lot of dialogues like that in the Blue Cliff Record. How should we take this monk? In this case, Yangshan is speaking with a monk who is nameless, although in other versions of the story, he's named, his name is Si Yi. But I believe that that's all we know about this monk, is that sometimes he's called Si Yi. So we'll just consider him the anonymous monk from now on. And it seems, from the way the dialogue goes, that this monk has been practicing for quite some time, that this monk has some ideas about himself and his understanding of the Dharma. Perhaps he's gone to Yangshan to test out his understanding. This is something that monks would do in ancient China and then later in Japan. They would reach a certain kind of understanding or realization and then leave their teachers, leave their home monastery, and go on their wanderings and stop in at various monasteries and have dialogues with the teacher, testing their own understanding, maybe testing the teacher as well. One of our readings says, find Zen teachers and show them your mind. And that's what this monk seems to be doing. And so, however this dialogue has begun, before we get to it, here's the monk encountering Yangshan, one of the most celebrated teachers of the time, a disciple of another great teacher, Guishan. And so Yangshan starts with an apparently simple question: where were you born? At least he didn't say, do you have any brothers and sisters? But this is could be the kind of question we say when we're just trying to start a conversation with someone we don't know very well. Where were you born? But it's interesting the way that it's translated. As I've looked at different translations and versions, I've been really impressed with the translation that's been handed down to us from some of our lineage teachers, whose names were just mentioned in the lineage in the ancestor dedication. Sometimes this is just translated, where are you from? Which is really the same question, but where were you born raises or makes clear the stakes, the potential stakes of a question like this. Where were you born makes us think of the great matter of birth and death. What is your relation to birth and death? Where were you born also makes me think of the later Japanese teacher, Bankei, who kept speaking all through his teaching career of the unborn. What is the unborn? How do we find the unborn? And this was something he developed from his understanding of back to China, the six ancestors, koan sometimes translated as, what is your original face before your parents were born? Or show me your original face before your parents were born. So where were you born? Lots of possible ways that the monk could go with this. But, you know, the monk doesn't want to get trapped too quickly. And so he gives a very direct answer. I'm from Yukon province, I would say. I'm from Seattle. Hard to be wrong about where you were born. You answered in this direct way. But Yangshan wants more. And so he raises the stakes a little bit. Do you consider the inside of it? That's kind of a cryptic remark for us, I think. You consider the inside of it. Maybe, though, gesturing towards those other issues that I was just pointing towards. Do you consider what it really means to be born? Do you consider where you're really from? I can say I was born in Seattle, but I have no memory of that. And it's been years and years and years since I lived in Seattle, many years even since I visited Seattle. Where am I really from right now? Where was I born? If you were to ask me where I'm from, What should I answer? Maybe not something that you could find from looking at my passport. If I were to ask you right now, where were you born? How would you answer? So being challenged in this way, do you consider the inside of it? The monk makes a claim. Many of these dialogues between fairly senior practitioners and teachers, if that's what this is, that's how I'm understanding it. Many of these dialogues include a kind of claim. Sometimes it's a little hidden. Sometimes it's more overt. And in this case, the monk's claim is, I always do. I always think of the inside of it. I'm never just talking in layman, direct, ordinary language terms. I always do. This reminds me of a koan from much later in the same collection, the Book of Serenity, when Dongshan answers the question by saying, I am always intimate with it. And this is a phrase that has resonated century after century throughout our tradition as an invitation to us, as a challenge to us. I'm always intimate with it. And this monk seems to be making a similar kind of claim. I always think of it. Does he? Do we believe him? Apparently, Yangshan thinks not. Because he now gives a little Dharma talk. So you get a mini Dharma talk within my Dharma talk, a mini Taisho within my Taisho. That which thinks is consciousness. Let's just make this clear. Let's start at the beginning. That which thinks is consciousness. That which is thought about is environment. Within that are mountains, rivers, and the great earth, towers, palaces, people, animals, and other things. This reminds me of what the Buddha said when he saw the morning star and was awakened and said, I and all beings and the great earth itself awaken together. This is a very broad and generous way of encountering the world. And then Yangshan goes on, but reflect upon the consciousness that thinks. Are there a lot of things there? What is the mind's relationship to the world? What is the relationship of consciousness and environment? Where and how do these two meet? This is a question that different Buddhist schools have had very different answers to. Mind-only school, no-mind school, everything in between. Zen has its own take on this. But Zen doesn't spell it out in philosophical or ideological terms. I don't see anything at all there, says the monk. I don't see anything at all there. Here's another claim, right? Nothing. I'm free of all that. No dust clinging here. This might remind us of Bodhidharma saying vast emptiness. But is the monk a red-bearded barbarian? Or is the monk just putting on a beard to see how it looks in the mirror? I don't see anything at all there. Is that really true? We read a brief reading this morning a little bit ago that says, your true self is the world. If your true self is the world, is there nothing at all in consciousness, in mind? Is it totally empty? Is that what we're aiming for? Because really, we're not aiming for some kind of quiescence. We talk about liberation, we talk about freedom, but we don't mean being freed, being liberated from the world. We don't mean being freed, being liberated from our karmic selves. That's an illusion and one that can get us in a lot of trouble. We talk about being freed from all of our concepts and preferences and ideas about how things should be and how they shouldn't be, and notions about who we are and how we got here. All of that that the brain and mind weave together. And it's kind of like, if you know the story of Ulysses and Penelope. Penelope weaves all day, and then so that she can buy some time waiting for Odysseus to come home, she unweaves a lot of what she wove during the day at night, because there are 50 suitors pressing for her hand, and she wants to wait for Odysseus. So our mind and brain weave together this notion, this picture of a world, this notion of a self, this story of who we are, and then it all unravels. No one has to work to unravel it. It just unravels by itself. And this constant work of weaving, this is something that we can never be entirely free of, but we can see it for what it is. We can start to understand just how illusory it all is. And so what we can be freed from are what the poet and mystic Blake called mind-forged manacles. The manacles we make for ourselves, weave for ourselves in our minds by getting stuck in fixed concepts of how the world is and how it should be and how we are and how we should be, generating so much suffering. So when the monk says, I don't see anything at all there, when the monk claims that there's nothing at all, no dust clinging, absolute clear mind, then Yangshan replies, that's correct so far as belief is concerned. I'm not sure what he means by belief here. Another translation might be doctrine, you know. That's correct so far as doctrine is concerned. That sounds like some of the things we were chanting in the Heart Sutra, but it's not enough for human life. We, in our Zen careers, we can find ourselves in a place where everything falls away. In fact, in some accounts of the Zen life of following the way, this is seen as crucial. Having an experience where everything falls away, and again, we don't get to see the universe as it is. That's not on offer. So just let that one go. But we get to see how illusory our picture of it has been all this time. Everything stripped away. But that's not where we can stay. Hakuin talks about this, and he says, don't stay there. Don't remain there. He talks about it as everything becoming brittle and shattering. And then he says, but don't remain there. And the monk seems to want to remain with that. But Yangshan says, it's not enough for human life. Oh, what a great opening. And it opens in all kinds of directions. One direction, something else that we encountered in our sutra service was Hongzhi's beautiful poem on silent illumination. And Hongzhi does not say in silent illumination, nothing at all is there. There's nothing at all in the mind. He says, clouds enveloping the peak, dew in the moonlight, a river of stars, pines covered with snow, all that on offer. When we did our meal service today, I was struck with how often we talked about other living beings. When you sit down to eat, I don't know if there are many more ego-directed activities than that, than putting food into your mouth. And it really, you know, it brings out that self that wants it now and wants as much as it can get. And so in Horyoki, we begin by saying, just enough, Horyoki. Let's not get greedy here. But we also think about all the other beings. We even think about the beings, the hungry ghosts, tortured spirits. We want them to be satisfied too. Not only all living beings, even hell beings, even pretas, hungry ghosts. If we live in complete emptiness, how do we reach out to other beings? How do we even acknowledge their existence? What motivates us to live the life not of a renunciate, not of someone even who has pass through it all and gets to be in a state of nirvana. That was an older way of Buddhism, a Theravada, or at least it's a caricature of it. But in Mahayana Buddhism, we don't want to stay in nirvana. We want to hold back. We want to stay in this world. We want to stay in this life and interact with other living beings and interact with the 10,000 things. There's another story about Yangshan that I wanted to read to you. And this one is a dialogue with his teacher, Guishan, back when Yangshan was still called Weiji. That was his name, his Dharma name. Yangshan became his name when he began his own monastery on Mount Yang. Shan means mountain. And so like many of the ancient Chinese teachers, he was named after the mountain where he taught, Mount Yang, Yangshan. But before that, he was Weiji. One day, Master Guishan asked Weiji, "How do you understand inconceivable, clear, bright mind?" This again might remind you of silent illumination in the poem we read a little bit ago. "How do you understand inconceivable, clear, bright mind?" Weiji said, "Mountains, river, the great earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars." The master said, "You only understand things." Weiji said, "Master, what did you ask me?" The master said, "How do you understand inconceivable, clear, bright mind?" Weiji said, "Why do you call it things?" The master approved. So this is one of those dialogues where teacher and student are becoming equal, where teacher and student are beginning to share one mind. And notice how different this is than the dialogue in our koan for this sesshin. How different the answer is. How can we understand this claim that is implicit in the second dialogue, the dialogue with Guishan? And once more, I find that a line from something in our sutra book is dancing through my head as I think through this. And that line is not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. So do you think of the inside of it? Do you get stuck there? Those are just things you're stuck outside. Izzy, what does it mean to be not stuck to inside, outside, or in between? Let me read the koan to you one more time. Yangshan asked the monk, "Where were you born?" The monk said, "I'm from Yu province." "Do you consider the inside of it?" "I always do." "That which thinks is consciousness. That which is thought about is environment. Within that are mountains, rivers, and the great earth, towers, palaces, people, animals, and other things. But reflect upon the consciousness that thinks. Are there a lot of things there?" "I don't see anything at all there." "That's correct as far as belief is concerned, but it's not enough for human life. Do you have some other advice?" "It doesn't hit the mark to say that sometimes there's something and sometimes there isn't. When you look, you only see a dark vastness. From now on, focus on sitting down and wearing clothes. Thank you." And now we'll move into Dharma dialogue. Please sit comfortably. And those of you at the end can move in so that you can see us and we can see you. Those of us on screen, please also sit comfortably. And we'll...
so we can see you.
And maybe Jenny, if you could just slide back a bit so I can see Jenny. And so please raise your Zoom hand or raise your physical hand and we will call on you, and there'll be a microphone that will pass around here. Our friends on screen don't need microphones, lucky them. And David and Melissa will help me to respond to your questions, comments, whatever is coming up, whether it's related to the Dharma talk or not. Yeah. Oh. Thank you. Anne.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. I was thinking this morning, this is going to start in the side, but end up by your talk. I was thinking this morning that I was never going to get used to the formality of Zen, that it's not my tradition. And then I thought, well, it's just a habit, what Melissa Roshi always calls habits. I'm used to things being very simple. And then I started wondering, could I take away the habits? What if I got rid of all my habits? And I didn't end up with a place of silent illumination. I ended up with something that was flat. So I'm with the monk. If I get rid of all the stuff I've added on, I seem to end up with something that is the blank slate, which is a little bit scary.
Yeah, it is a little bit scary, isn't it? It's funny that you said that you don't like all the forms, but you like things to be simple. And of course, we try to make all the forms fairly simple. And the longer you do them, the simpler they become. You start to really appreciate the simplicity of something that at first is terribly complicated. We're not doing formal Oriyoki practice, and yet it becomes simple over the years, although it's still opportunity for mistakes. But tell me a little bit more about that blankness that frightens you. That flatness.
Well, if I see myself as just this combination of habits piled on since the beginning, since I came out of the womb, maybe since before I came out of the room. And if I could ever imagine they're all gone away, there's nothing there in my head. There's nothing there.
Yeah. Well, what if they're still there, but you have a different relationship to them? Does that seem possible?
Not where I am now, but I'll think about it. I have 2 days to think about it.
Well, I hope you don't spend the whole session sitting and thinking, although that is a habit many of us have, right? So I think the little phrase I heard and what you said is getting rid of habits. That's not what we're doing. If we try to get rid of habits, then we're fighting with ourselves. So instead, we become intimate, as Alan was talking about this. We really get to know what these mind habits and behavioral habits are. And we see them clearly. And then they begin to transform all by themselves. But if we put energy and effort into getting rid of them, then they fight back. And the result is dullness or extreme agitation or, you know, many different things, because we're all different. So I have two pieces of advice for you, although we don't like to give advice. One is don't sit and think about all this. Really practice with your main practice, which is either, I'm not going to say what yours is, but shikantaza, breath practice. Maybe you're doing the nub of a koan. Really stay. This is an amazing opportunity to do that, because the mind loves to just chatter. And the second piece of advice is, don't try to get rid of anything. Become intimate with everything that arises, because that's the Buddha Dharma showing itself, including the flatness, by the way, but we could go on. Thank you, Anne.
Anyone in the Zendo? Yeah, Mitch.
Yeah, I don't have any questions or insights, but I just sometimes when I'm in a certain state, I just find it so amusing. the whole thing, and especially your presentation, because it's poetic and it's historical, and it's just like, what the hell were these people doing? Like nobody in the 21st century that I can figure out has come up with something like that. And the fact that it's lasted this long and it has this much richness is just, I'm just kind of in awe of it. So.
Well, and I think as we hear these stories of the tradition, we can notice that some really inspire that, like, oh my goodness, this there's something so clear. And I can also inspire, what the heck,
right?
Why have we preserved this story of people babbling nonsense, right? Noticing all of this that arises, and when the appreciation arises, there's some kind of resonance. We say the ancestors are not somewhere else, but here they are, Yangshan, come to visit us today. Yeah. Thanks.
And I also wanted to say, Rich, when you said, what were they doing? I wanted to say they were sitting and wearing clothes and eating food. Angela.
So it was an interesting morning for me because, I think my volumes. So I realized I was in my ADD mode, and I realized like it was an actual, like I actually have it. And because I went from one thing, starting one thing and then totally forgetting what I was doing to going somewhere else. And, you know, I was like, oh, should I medicate myself or just like, no, you know, because I didn't take medication this morning. But I don't know. And then I realized like, oh, no, that's just how my brain is. And I finally kind of accepted that's just kind of how my brain works. And then I missed being in the Zendo. I was like, oh, there's just white walls and like there's nothing around. And I'm you know, someone else's coffee master, you know, and I kind of miss that.
Yeah. Thanks, Angela. And, you know, when you said, should I medicate myself? I also heard, should I meditate myself? And it seems like that was the decision you made, which I applaud. I think coming and sitting is just the right thing to do in a mood like that, when there's lots to work with. There's lots to, we talked last night about the difficulty of just sitting, and even more difficult when there's so much dancing, swimming, flying around in one's head. I think it's a great practice to just, you know, go ahead and show up as you did and sit with us.
Thank you. So, I had a hard time following the koan, but there were two things that came up. One was when you were saying we get free from our comparing things to how they are, to how we think they should be, or letting go of how we think things should be. And just in my role here, I'm thinking about the forms and how we think Sesshin should be. And I don't know, just like the seeming paradox of all of it, that that it's this attachment that frees us. And the other thing, the Dharma name, the Wuji, I don't even know if it's the same characters or anything, but there's a pose at the very beginning of the Tai Chi form called Wuji, and it means before the beginning.
I do think it's a different characters, but that's beautiful. I think it's Weiji, but I'm not sure. I think the trouble comes in when we make a separation between, say, form and emptiness, right? Between the forms and some idea that we have about the way things should be. Then it becomes a paradox, as you say. But this is not a paradox. This is where everything comes together. We often talk in Zen, the paradox of koans and the paradox of the Heart Sutra. I think that's a little bit misleading. And that's why when this koan ends with just, you know, wear your clothes, come on, sit, do your thing, it does simplify itself. It's the mind that makes things complicated.
Yeah, and in a sense, our forms are a kind of clothes we're putting on. I think there is a tendency to want to go naked. I mean, be free. I don't want any habits, please. I want to be beyond habits. Then we can worry about, if I didn't have habits, who would I be? But this possibility of in the form, in the activity, even in the comparing mind, this should have happened, that should have happened. How do we find the freedom right here? Because there, there is a lot in running sesshin and a lot of choreography we're in the middle of. And there are moments where we can forget ourselves in the middle of it, right? And those are lovely. But there are also moments of self-consciousness. What am I supposed to do now? I was supposed to do that, but I did this. As Melissa said, how do we not make a separation, right? Always here. Completely.
Thanks. Susan.
So first of all, thank you for your talk, although I'm just right now resonating still with what David just right now said in terms of not making separations, because this is what my mind is doing all the time. Alan, I loved your talk, and it brought my mind into so many different territories, with comments, with judgments, with additional teachings, with experiences I had, with a lot, and it was almost too much for me. What was going on during the talk. And then I noticed I had moments where I just felt touched. Mm-hmm. And these moments of being touched I appreciate highly. So as well, when the question was coming up, so what was it what the people were doing thousands of years ago? So the same thing what we are doing here. And I mean, and not intellectually, I mean, we can say, yeah. But really, there is no difference in a way how their mind worked to my mind or your mind and our minds. It's just the human condition, and they had different circumstances than me and you. Mm. And I love this. And there is this, what we heard several times within Boundless Way Zen, so being free in the midst of, not being free from or of. And to remember, there is, I think it says in the liturgy book, no ice without water. So it's everything is here. And I really try often to kill what I don't like. and to get what I want, which is the disease of the mind. And I think really boiling it down, it's just to shut up what I do in a few moments. And to sit quietly.
Yeah, thanks so much, Susan. And you know, what I really want to bring out from what you said so beautifully is what you said about this feeling of connection to these, you know, ancient Chinese teachers who lived more than 1,000 years ago, and then having these moments where we're moved and we realize that they were asking the same questions. Also, you know, teaching us in the future how to ask them. They were having the same doubts, experiences, some of the same issues, same blockages. And at the beginning, near the beginning of The Gateless Gate, Wu Men talks about this sensation you can have of your eyebrows mingling with the eyebrows of the ancients. And I think that's, even though I'm losing my eyebrows, I still love that image. I still think it can happen. They just have to lean a little bit closer to me.
It's a saying that if you lose your eyebrows, you know that you're no longer preaching the Dharma. Yeah. You know, I want to really, I wasn't sure if I should say this or not, but I think it really comes back. I can't see Susan anymore because we don't have the gallery view. But you said something, Susan, so important, I think, and I agree with Alan, such beautiful way of evoking the being touched part. And also the naming of the feeling overwhelmed part by too many words, you know, I couldn't. And there's that separation again. This is really good, you know, mingling the eyebrows and being touched. And this is what we want. But the other part is also, if you can want that, if you can want, that's like wearing clothes. That's just ordinary life. Things are overwhelming. They're too much. I can't follow it. My mind is full. This koan's hard. You know, even though Alan explicated it very clearly, still, it's complex. It moves around. So it's very important to notice any gap between the things we think we want and the things we think we don't want. Very, very important. Thank you.
Adam.
Thank you for the talk. A couple things resonated. I think most strongly is this feeling of no separation, and in particular between mind and environment. I've been thinking recently about how language plays into this, and how, like, in our language, you know, there's always an actor and then something being acted on. But in other cultures, you know, they would just say, like, swimming or eating or something like that. But here we always say, like, I'm the one that's doing it. You know, like, my mind is separate from my environment. And I was cleaning recently, and I spent a significant amount of time in my home, 3, 4, 5 hours cleaning up my meditation space, my office space. And when I started, I had this real feeling of distinct separation. There's this room that I need to take care of, and there's me, and I'm going to take care of this room. But as time progressed, I realized that it was sort of blending into the same thing. And I was just, oh, that doesn't go there. It was like the objects were speaking to me. And I realized, like, it's actually a huge part of my mind and my mental peace of mind that when I enter that space, like, I just feel better, you know, after it, when it's sort of organized. And I felt like, oh, I'm part of this. There is no separation between what I think is me and what I think I'm doing here. So that kind of moved me. But then the other thing that really jumped out at me was about dust. And I thought about how, you know, in the one view, you know, we have that emptiness perspective or whatever. Well, there's no dust. There's no place for any dust to alight. But I want to say that, you know, in the realm of human beings, like, there is dust, and it gathers and it collects, and it needs some mindful attention too. And maybe it's me. It was really moving. I really appreciate this talk. Thank you.
Yeah. And Adam, I appreciate you talking about, there are ways we can cooperate with our life. And of course, ways we can complain, and both are fine. Of course, you're never alone. The world is always here. The Dharma is always here. And what a joy when we dance together, or when we realize that we've always been dancing together, whatever we do. Thanks.
Yes.
I'd like to get Adam to come and put my office in order. So, Alan, thank you very much. I was having some difficulty following the koan, the first koan, the dialogue between Yangshan and his student. But all of the references that you made subsequently really helped me. And I'm especially struck by the contrast between the two dialogues, whereas the first monk is making a claim, and eventually he is sent back to the cushion, basically, you know, sit down and wear your clothes. The other monk has a handle on this idea that that language is problematic, you know, so he points out to the teacher that, you know, why are you always talking about things? And I think that well, both of them, just because you contrasted them, I feel like I have a better handle on both of them. That I suspect that, you know, in the first injunction, wear your clothes, there's something right under my nose that I'm missing. In the second one, I guess that, you know, what was most helpful to me was your quoting from the sutra book, The Grass-Roofed Hermitage, not stuck to inside, outside, and in between, which is a real, for me, a real warning about language and about conceptualizing what the practice is all about. So I just love these, the way in which you linked these different different koans and different quotations. Thank you.
Yeah, nothing to add. So we have hands on screen, but is there anyone in the Zendo who would like a turn? Well, let's go to screen again. Esther.
Yes, so two words stayed with me, the inside it, and then the, you know, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between, is taking me to the point of so important to be inside, being stuck inside, outside, and in between, mm-hmm. and to enter my life and explore it from the inside rather than think about it, trying to get more intimacy through trying to figure out what is going on. And I think that's where the just wear your clothes, okay, you know, just wear your life, be inside this life from moment to moment and see what's there.
Yeah, the same song of the Grassroot Hermitage says, turn the light to shine within, then just return. And so, you know, this is what you're talking about, I think. Turning the light to shine on the stuckness and not trying to wriggle out of it. But yeah, really, you know, but examine it and study it and see what that Dharma gate opens out into.
Were you going to say something, Esther?
Well, I was also, you know, there was something about the, I for sure know that longing to the spaciousness inside the small places. And I'm getting more and more curious about the sort of a crowdedness mm-hmm. of life and these places. So rather than looking for a freedom in the middle of it, I want to know, and I'm surely having many lessons right now in fully filtered in or like entangled in all sorts of sticky stuff. And how is it to be there?
Yeah, exactly. That was the point I was trying to make before. I think you said it very beautifully. And your hand movements were very important too. Yeah, sticky, it's entangled. But we tend to turn away from it thinking this isn't it. Mm-hmm. And then we think, we strategize. We say, I'm going to go into it and then I'll find freedom in it, which is just like being stuck in, you know, the one place again. But to actually realize that our life includes the sticky, entangled places, it's not all gorgeous and wonderful forever. It's painful. The Buddha's first teaching was that life is painful, right? And so it's not like an inconvenient painful. It's a pointing out of what you're talking about, I think exactly. Can we move into these moments that are difficult for us? Period. And that's, oh, and now this is going to transform and I'm going to get to see beautiful things and flowers and trees and everything will be great all the time. And then, of course, we keep getting interrupted no matter what's happening. It's like there's a bird singing outside our window. I don't know if you can pick it up, right? So just to allow yourself to be with those things doesn't mean you get stuck in them or adhere. They are sticky, but to just really say, this too, right? Wouldn't that be amazing? And that is what we're trying to point out, but it's hard. It's so hard. It's not easy. Yeah. Thank you. I noticed before you call in anybody here that Joanne had her hand up too, but she put it down. Oh, maybe it's gone.
Thank you. I just...
Oh, she did?
I just couldn't... It's hard for me to find the right words all the time. I really appreciated the talk and everyone's words and... the contrast poem, the contrast koan. I couldn't hear very well at first. So it really it really helped me pull together again the way I don't give myself over to what can be safe. I unwittingly separate myself even from what is safe. And the forms actually are like lily pads to safety in a lot of ways. The lack of confidence, like, so just this beautiful thing of it's okay to be human with a human. Like, it really, even though you think there's something else going on, there's really not anything else going on.
Joanne is, well, everyone who's speaking, I hope you can all hear, everyone is coming forward. And I love this boiling down the teachings of Zen, of life. It's okay to be human with other humans. This is our life and everything comes up and not a problem. Yeah, thanks, Joanne.
Barry, would you like the last word of Zen this morning?
Well, that's an intimidating how about a word? I wanted to say that I love habits and I love forms. And when I travel and my habits are disrupted, it's quite annoying. I think routine is great. And Zen routine is comforting too, because it's predictable. I do have these occasional experiences of boundlessness, and they're just little flashes. And I can't bring them on. They come on their own. And they often involve birds or my dog or my grandson, some sort of vibrant, free spirit. And they last a very brief time, but they're great gifts. And then I can retreat back into my habits and forms, and that's fine with me. So I hear people talking about many variations of this relationship between habits and emptiness, and I love hearing the variations from all of you.
Yeah, thank you, Barry. And mainly I want to say yes. and the one thing I would play with a little bit is when you said, then I can retreat into my habits. And I would say, then I can move confidently forward into back into my habits. Mm-hmm.
So let's come back, restore the Zendo back into our Zazen posture.